worry, no sweets. Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bro. Curry.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 62 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we'll be talking about what we've been eating, discuss some vegan news, and then conclude by asking the question, are online petitions bad for animals?
How could that be?
I guess we'll find out.
Paul.
Yes, Andy.
Before you ask me what we've been eating, I just wanted to say that we've neglected to mention on our last episode, we had our month-long break, and during that time, we got a bunch of really great iTunes reviews from some wonderful beardos out there. So just want to say thank you to everyone that has done that. It is something that helps us out immensely and makes us feel good about ourselves. So if you have a couple minutes, go give us a rate and a review, and that would help us out. So thanks again to everyone that's done that.
Thank you. So let's get into the food. Andy, we went somewhere together. We were itching to talk about it last time, but we already had a lot of food stuff to talk about.
We went on a hot date.
We did. It was a not an inexpensive date.
Not a cheap date.
So Andy and I, we were in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago, at this point a couple weeks ago, and we had both separately been to Veg with different little mixed feelings about that.
Both enjoyed.
Yes.
Paul liked it a lot more than I did.
Yes.
But I still really liked it.
Yeah. Don't backtrack on your words. But we both had the opportunity to go to V Street, which, have you been there before?
No.
And I had never been there before either.
As far as I know, it's relatively new.
Yeah, I know. I had heard about it. I had known people that have gone to it, but I had not been to it yet myself. So I was excited, especially because I had such a positive experience at Veg, and this is like the street food version of Veg. So I was very excited to try it out.
Yeah. Me too.
So we did not make reservations or anything. Luckily, we were able to get... We got there early. I guess we got there for an early-ish dinner.
Yeah, it turns out not making reservations is a mistake.
No, but we got to sit at like the... I actually like... We sat at the bar watching the people cook, like watching the chefs cook, which I think is kind of fun.
It was way cooler.
Yeah.
We got to guess if things were ours that were coming out and then being upset about things we didn't order that looked really good.
Yeah, yeah. So it was cool, but I think definitely if we had gone an hour or two later, would have had a little bit more trouble probably finding a seat.
Yeah, but so Paul, safe to say overall, we both really enjoyed this dining experience.
Oh yeah.
We got a lot of food.
Yes, and shout out to Ashley for hooking us up with some food as well.
Yeah, more food more than food, we can handle.
more food, and I'll say this, debatably the best item that we had that we would not have gotten otherwise.
That is a bold statement, Paul.
I'm standing by it.
Are you given a preemptive star of the meal?
maybe, because I think you know what you think my star of the meal is.
I just wrote down what I assumed it was based on your reaction. I put two down for myself and one for you, and I was like, Paul can fill in the other one. So what is the dish you're talking about?
Well, the dish that I think might be my favorite dish was the Peruvian fries, and they had an
Ahi Amarillo
sauce, which was the sauce, I think, was the star of the meal.
The sauce, you might say, was the boss.
You might. And then there was also peanuts and dried olives on it. Don't care for dried olives, but loved this.
They were minimal. Like, honestly, if I didn't know there was peanuts on there, I wouldn't have even known. Yeah.
But they were big.
Secret sneaky peanuts.
Sneaky peanuts.
And we had them leave off the vile weed cilantro.
Much to my displeasure. Actually, I really don't care. But they were like big wedge fries. That's what you would call them, right?
Yeah.
Big wedge fries.
Not my preferred potato delivery method, but.
Usually not mine either, but it worked. I think it worked for this.
Good for holding the sauce.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there was just this cheesy sauce just slathered all over it. And that sauce, I think I would literally put on anything and it would make it absolutely delicious.
It was really good.
So I think that might be the best thing I had. However, what Andy had assumed that would be my favorite was the seitan kebab. Andy, did I say that correctly?
You did.
I did. I upon reviewing it, I don't know if we even said this last episode, but Andy has pointed out that I pronounce Satan wrong. I typically pronounce it Satan, which I think is just easier to say for me. So I'm going to probably keep saying it, but now I'm just very self-conscious about it. And when I was listening to the last episode, I noticed that I said Satan about 17 times.
I'm sorry, Paul.
It's all right. But the Satan kebabs that came with this fattoush salad, harissa mint, and whipped tahini and cured tofu. So like, it was basically like the seitan kebab, and then there was a salad on the side. All that other stuff was in the salad, but the kebab itself, this and the salad was like okay. I was like okay. I wouldn't get that as a main. Like if that was just it, that was a salad, I probably wouldn't get it. But the seitan was similar-ish to the seitan that I had at Veg, in that it was kind of like charred and had that kind of burnt flavor to it that I loved so much. It was in small cubes, which was different than the Veg seitan, and the Veg seitan I think had a slightly better consistency. Like it was a little more peely and chickeny, I guess. So this was a little different. I didn't enjoy, well, I don't even want to say I didn't enjoy it as much, because it was still, I enjoyed it a lot. It didn't have that same chickeny consistency that the Veg one did, but it was still absolutely delicious.
Yeah, it had a great char.
Great char.
The char was the star.
Char was the star. So those were my two favorites. And Andy, what were yours?
Mine was also the Peruvian fries, but also these dandan noodles.
These dang dandan noodles.
Dandan noodles. They came with five spice mushrooms, zucchini, and this red chili sesame sauce. It was they warned us that it was spicy. And I was like, whatever, people always warn you of that and it's not spicy.
Yeah.
But then we started getting dishes that we were not warned about that were like had a good kick to them.
Yeah.
And I was like a little worried about these dandan noodles now. And they were on the cusp of what was enjoyable to me, you know? Yeah. But
I was sweating a little bit.
Yeah. Flavor was off the charts.
Oh yeah.
It was really good.
The mushrooms were out of this world.
Paul, I have a confession.
Yes, Andy? You don't like mushrooms?
I think I can no longer say that I don't like mushrooms. I don't think that I can even say that I sometimes like mushrooms. I think I just straight up like mushrooms now.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Because I'm always getting things with mushrooms. But I'm like, no, mushrooms are gross. Why would I ever eat them? But then I just keep seeing them on menu items. And I'm just like, it looks really good.
These mushrooms, I think, were like made to perfection.
Yeah,
like,
they were crispy and flavorful.
Oh, yeah. And it was like, I think these were some of the best mushrooms that I've ever had.
And the noodles were great.
There was
some fresh ramen noodles or something.
Oh, no, I want that. I want that again right now.
I know. I actually got my dad the V Street cookbook for Christmas, and the dandan noodle recipe is in it. So I'm going to make it at some point.
Nice.
It calls for so much sriracha as well as like other chilies. So I think if I cut that down a little bit, it'd be perfect for me.
Nice. And for me, when you make it for me too?
I'll make it for you, Paul.
Yes.
So there was something that was kind of in the back of my mind when we were eating at V Street, and I started to explore it a little bit afterwards, something that kind of maybe bothers me about it.
Okay.
So the whole concept behind the place is it's like street food from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these dishes represent various locations around the world that the two white affluent restaurateurs that started this place went to. And this is not a cheap place. This is not a cheap place at all. And the stuff they're taking inspiration from is very generally cheap, like street food, food of the people.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's so many restaurants that do this, and maybe it's just so common that I don't really notice it. But this is something that was very specifically like, hey, these are Peruvian fries, and this is the kebab from here. And so maybe it was just more apparent. And so I was like thinking about it afterwards, and it felt like there was a lot of Columbusing going on, you know, like it was like, here is this couple that's traveled the world and has discovered this food. Yeah. And now they're going to take it and they're going to like make it upscale and charge a bunch of money for it for, you know, it's like what, $12 to $15 for a small plate.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's so many restaurants that I love that are, you know, white people doing other kind of cultures, cuisines. I'm not sure exactly where that line is, but I don't know. It was something that's kind of in the back of my head, especially with Veg or V Street, because that's like the concept of the restaurant.
Hmm.
What do you think?
I think I'll say this. I think they could have, at least from in my perspective, because I didn't think about that until you just brought it up right now. I think in my mind, they definitely could have, it definitely could have been worse. Like there could have been like in terms of the, like the decor, and I feel like how the menu is laid out and stuff like that. Besides the fact that you're right, they do say like Peruvian fries and stuff like that. I feel like not much attention is brought to that. I could be wrong. Maybe yeah. I just didn't look around enough.
Yeah.
I think more attention could have been brought to that fact, which I think would have been a little more questionable.
Yeah, and they didn't necessarily present it as like, this is the authentic cuisine of this area. Yeah. Like, we got this banh mi toast that it barely resembled a banh mi. It just had some of the flavors of a banh mi. I just want Paul to experience a real banh mi. And also, I think about, like, you know, we want everyone to be vegan, so it's like, okay, well, we need these fancier high-end vegan places to appeal to a certain sect of the population. So
yeah,
I don't know. I got all sorts of feelings about this.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't think about it until 10 seconds ago when you just told me. But my initial reaction, and I'm of course willing to change this or hear criticisms of this, is that it wasn't like exploiting it. At least that's what I felt.
Well, I mean, they're making money off of other people's cuisine.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it.
I don't have the answers, yeah. But I would feel remiss if I did not bring it up.
Although I feel like it's because it's not, and like you said, it's not trying to be like, this is the authentic, like you said, it's not trying to be like, this is the authentic, like, banh mi that we're making. It seems more so like it was inspired by these things.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily think is bad.
I don't know. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying either way.
Yeah.
But it is something that sort of popped into my mind. But, I mean, suffice to say, the food was fantastic. You can find pictures of it at our Instagram,
Andy, the Bearded Vegans. Andy took some great pictures. I think I referenced in the last episode how great your picture-taking capabilities are.
You did. So that was really fun. Overall, I really enjoyed the experience. Yeah. I think we were both... I was way more satisfied after that meal than the one at at Veg, which, again, I did really like. But I guess this type of food and whatnot just sort of speaks to me a lot more than what Veg is doing.
Yeah. And you know, just I'm still thinking about it. I feel like a lot of restaurants that are just like not necessarily a specific type of cuisine, just like, this is a fancy restaurant. It's like you'll see one or two dishes that are clearly like not just American food and stuff like that. Is that the same thing?
Maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like gentrifying food.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Perfectly phrased.
Thank you. But I see that as different. I don't see those two things as super comparable, because this is one restaurant doing that. And it's like, obviously, like, I don't want to say something like, oh, if you can't afford to eat at this restaurant. But I mean, there are more upscale restaurants that you can expect are going to be more expensive. But I think it's bad if you're making all, like, if there's one specific type of food that all of a sudden all of that gets marked up, and then you are no longer have access to that specific food. I think that's like a different issue, and that's more, I think, troubling than just like one restaurant that's doing this. Obviously, it's not just one restaurant, but
obviously, even if one person is doing it, it's not good.
Yeah,
I guess I'm not willing to just give them a pass.
Yeah,
I am. Like many things, my favorites are problematic, and this is just like a food favorite that is problematic.
No, I agree. I would definitely be willing to like sit down and explore more.
All right.
On a different episode.
Okay. Well, that was V Street. Let's move along.
We got a little bit of like bearded veganness in there.
Yeah, we did. Paul.
Yes, Andy?
I have been introduced to two new places in New York City that I was not even aware existed until a little while before actually going to them.
Mm-hmm.
So my partner and I were planning to go to one restaurant. Things didn't quite work out, and we were like in a certain area and just opened up Happy Cow and like okay, nothing all vegan. Let's go to the vegetarian. And this place called Black Flamingo was very close by.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, yeah, let's go there. And we went, and it's kind of like it's a bar, but there wasn't a lot of people in there when we got there. And it's like they do tacos and quesadillas and things like that. And having had the food, I'm like even like reticent to even call it inspired by Mexican because it's so far off from what Mexican is. Just sort of the delivery vehicle happens to be like a tortilla.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been to a bunch of places like this and you're like, okay, the food is fine. Mm-hmm. This food was phenomenal. It was amazing. It was so good. I cannot wait to go back and try more.
Huh.
We got, it was like happy hour pricing. So the tacos were a little bit cheaper. So we just got every taco, like six of them, six different ones. And it's all just really interesting flavor pairings. My favorite one was, as you notice the theme here, the savory shroom taco. And it's a crispy herb mushroom croquette, Brazilian collard, fried leek, truffle cashew crema, and an almond parm.
Mm.
It was just so good. Yeah, it was amazing.
Really good.
And my second favorite one was called the jam. And within the taco, a crispy potato latke, guava jam, fried garlic, chive dill crema, red onion, escabeche. And they had, I think that one also had, basically everything could be ordered vegan if you wanted it. Mm-hmm. So they had like cheeses listed, but then they had their vegan kind of version of it.
Yeah.
But everything was really good. So much so that we're like, we should get other things. Like, you know, we opened it up and kind of joked that they had a three bean chili, which is like the most basic, like it's like up there with like a tempeh Reuben or like a hummus wrap. You're just like, yeah, everybody has that. And it's super boring. But the food was so good. I was like, maybe that three bean chili is good. But we got the my favorite thing was this wild mushroom quesadilla. Had shishito peppers, grilled oyster mushrooms, and this cashew cheese that my partner had to keep reminding me. Like, I was like, I think they might have messed up. It's like, tastes like cheese. And I'd be like, no, okay, no, it's cashew. And she'd be like, it's definitely cashew cheese.
That's so funny.
It was really good.
That's awesome.
So
I want to go there.
I can't wait to go back. I think you would love it, Paul. Yeah. Really interesting flavor combinations.
Yeah.
It was a cool setting. It was like pretty chill. They're playing like Erykah Badu over the PA.
Cool.
It was very filled up by the time we left. So I would suggest getting there if that's not your thing.
Mm-hmm. Which it is not.
get there early and enjoy it. Our server, Danny, what a nice guy. What a nice person. Gave us good recommendations. It was a lot of fun. So that's Black Flamingo.
That sounds good.
And then the final place that I will talk about is a French restaurant called Delice and Saracen.
Oh.
And I will say right off the bat, this is not my wheelhouse. This is not flavor profiles that I am used to consuming, like a lot of kind of like red wine, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but we went and it was a really cute little place. There's like maybe 10 or 12 tables that are like two person tables and they're all like 4 inches apart, like really cute. Could definitely be romantic in like the evening time. And
you went at 7 a.m.
They actually open at 10 a.m. They phrase it as they're two separate restaurants in one. One is the vegan French place and the other is a crêperie, which is also a French thing.
Yeah.
So they had a vegan foie gras, which not the first vegan foie gras I've had.
Yeah.
And it was good. I didn't like love it. It wasn't like the most amazing thing, but it was just like, oh, I can't believe they have this.
Do you like put it on crackers? Is that what you do?
They give you bread to kind of spread it on. A little bread spread, if you will.
A little bread spread.
Yeah. And then they also had a cheese plate that was house-made cheeses.
Oh.
Fantastic.
Really?
So good. They had like one that had like, I don't know, it's like blue algae or like spirulina or something. And there's like kind of waves of blue in it.
Oh, cool.
And like they had like a spicy smoky one and one that was like, I think a goat cheese, if I remember correctly. And there's one other one. It was just really good.
Andy, I'm getting real excited hearing you talk about these foods.
it was good. I would love to have that cheese plate again. And I got the bœuf bourguignon.
What was that, Andy?
I'm sorry. I coughed. I don't know what to say. We got a couple things with them. We also got the steak frites. So the bœuf bourguignon, it's like a red wine stew kind of thing with like fingerling potatoes and carrots and whatnot. The thing that kind of struck me as odd was that the beef was just like Mewa. Like I believe that's the brand. It's the stuff they use at Chinapan.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was cooked so much better than Chinapan. Like, oh, it was all so like funny. Tender and juicy and stuff. But it was weird. This is not a cheap place at all. I spent a lot of money on food recently. It was like and looking at their Instagram pictures, it looked like their chicken breast was like a Gardein chicken breast.
Yeah.
And it was just weird seeing like $25 entrees with like a Gardein breast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, I guess what else would they use? They're not manufacturing their own, but it just kind of cheapened it.
Oh, yeah,
in definitely. Some way. Like, it was just really like threw me out of it. And the steak frites, I'm convinced it was actually just a Beyond Burger. But my partner just assured me that it was not. Like, the menu said it was three different types of mushroom and stuff.
Yeah.
But it tasted so much like the Beyond Burger.
That's so funny.
But anyway, but overall, I really enjoyed the experience. It was like a change of pace. You know, it's not the type of thing that, like, speaks to me in the way that, like, Black Flamingo did or something. But overall, I was like, this is cool. I'm glad that this exists. That, you know, again, it's like we want all echelons of society to be vegan. So those that are more inclined to go out and go to a fancy French restaurant, this place even had vegan escargot, which was just like mushrooms and butter sauce and
interesting,
you know, things like that you don't normally see. However, the weird thing was they're marketing themselves as like a vegan restaurant,
yeah,
100% vegan. And like the first page menu says like 100% vegan and organic. But then on the back, there's like an asterisk in one of the crepe sections and it says can be made vegan. And I was like, that's weird. Cause on their website, when I was looking, it listed vegan in front of everything that would be like ham, Gruyere cheese, or, you know, stuff like that. On the menu, they didn't list vegan in front of everything. So there's one crepe that had honey and I was like, that must be what they're referring to.
Yeah.
And we didn't get a crepe anyway, so we didn't really ask questions. However, Abby, who runs the A Soybean blog, upon me posting this, was like, I posted they were all vegan. She's like, aren't they just vegetarian? She did some great investigative journalism. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but we'll throw a link to her article in the show notes there. But she had not a great experience there. Ooh. And there's kind of a whole hubbub about how they've been marketed as vegan, but they don't have all vegan stuff.
Yeah.
And like she went in and it was like breakfast. So she was like, oh, do you have croissants? Like the classic vegan thing.
Yeah.
And like one of the co-owners that was serving her said, no, that's, you know, typically that's made with butter. And it was like, you're serving like vegan duck breast and like you can't crack the code on
butter.
A croissant.
Yeah.
Like I can name half a dozen places that make vegan croissants really well. So this is like a very weird thing.
Yeah.
But through a bunch of exchanges, it was kind of revealed that like the family is pretty recently vegan, the people that opened it. And they kind of view a lot of French people as very stubborn. And they think that like by offering the cheese, that'll open them up to trying the meat alternatives.
Yeah.
And like, I get that. And I'm not from France. I don't really know the culture, but I also was like, you could say that about any culture for the most part, that they're really stubborn. Like when people are like, oh, I'm going to Texas, be like, oh, Texas meat country. I'm like,
yeah,
oh, I got a ton of vegan restaurants there. I feel like it's kind of a cop out. And it's again, like run your restaurant, how you're going to run it. But to me, that seems like a weird justification that he's not giving French people enough credit that they would be willing to try those things. Yeah. Especially if the place is marketed as all vegan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not.
Like, who's going in there expecting to actually get cheese, you know?
Yeah.
Like, no one's, like, accidentally going in there. You know, it was just very odd thing. So go check out the blog post about that.
Is that all we got for food?
That's a lot of food talk. I thought we had a lot of food talk last time. We would have topped it this time. But all the places that we've been to this week were really good and deserve a little extra time. Again, pictures can be found over at our Instagram, which is The Bearded Vegans, or you can find a link to our Instagram at our new website, thebeardedvegans.com.
Hell yeah. Let's get into the news. So in the news, we got two articles. Three articles.
We got three articles.
Three articles.
I know. And the first one is also related to food. Paul.
Yes, Andy.
On the show, we have talked about both the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger.
Yes.
You have tried the Beyond Burger. You talked about last episode. I have tried the Impossible Burger twice. Love it. Mm-hmm. I think it's way better than the Beyond Burger, which is saying something because I think the Beyond Burger is quite good.
Yeah, it's great.
And I remember when we've talked about these things, we've kind of talked a little bit about their availability and their strategy and how they're kind of rolling out. And my inclination, based off of what we've seen, is that the Impossible Burger is taking this very elitist kind of approach. Like they're just in these really fancy restaurants. You can only get it for lunch at a certain time. And it's like kind of exciting getting it. But at the same time, it's like I try it. And I'm like, it's so good. I want everyone to have it. I didn't really have any confirmation that was actually their strategy. And I came across this article at QZ.com, post a link in the show notes, called Behind the Fight to Convince People to Buy Meatless Burgers. And the whole thing is like is pretty interesting because it's comparing and contrasting the very different approaches taken by Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods.
Yeah.
So before we talk about that, I'm just going to read a little quote from the article here. Two high-profile companies are competing to find an answer to that very challenge, the challenge of which being discussed by the article is how to sell these meatless burgers. Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods both produce meatless burgers, but each has taken a radically different approach to attracting consumer attention. Beyond Meat is committed to getting into supermarkets where large numbers of shoppers rolling carts by the meat section can take a look at its product, probably for the first time in their lives. By contrast, Impossible Foods is using social media and celebrity chefs to drive attention to select few restaurants serving its product, a strategy that generates a lot of buzz, but doesn't necessarily get a huge volume of people trying the product. And so, Paul, you've read the article.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of these two approaches?
I think that, you know what? I think it's okay because, again, I haven't tried the Impossible Burger, and I trust you that it's better than the Beyond Burger, but I think the Beyond Burger is very, very good and something, a product that is like, I know we use this phrase a lot, a game changer, but I think the fact that they are both comparable to each other and they are taking these completely different approaches, I think that it's okay then. It's okay that they're doing this because it's almost like they are taking like the exact opposite strategies. So you're going to hit the people in two different ways. You're going to hit people that are going to be more inclined to try something because it's been hyped up so much, like the Impossible Burger. And you're going to get people like the everyday person that is just walking in a supermarket and because it's so accessible or it's trying to be so accessible. So I think that it's almost, I think it's almost kind of good that they're doing this, because if you had the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger both doing the same thing, maybe both taking the Beyond Burger route of just getting it as accessible as possible, then it's just kind of two good options, but the average consumer only really needs one of them, so they'll probably just figure out whichever one's better and just get that one. This way you're kind of I feel like you're expanding the number of people that you're hitting with all these, with these two burgers. So I really think it's okay. I think if just the Impossible Burger existed and it was just doing that, I wouldn't agree with that because it's just not accessible at all.
Yeah. I think that just maybe just because I think the Impossible Burger is like, is truly the game changer.
Yeah.
Like I think the Beyond Burger is very good, but I think it's playing in the same game.
Oh,
same board, same pieces, same dice. And like the Impossible Burger is like whipping out some cards. Like it is, to me, it is
what game we playing here, Andy? Cards, dice, boards, pieces.
It's like, you know, something that's seemingly going to come in like a tub, like a little package of ground beef. You can do whatever you want with it. Yeah. And it, to me, it's like gross how real it is.
Yeah.
And so, I'm thinking actually about our conversation we had many, many moons ago about, should animal rights documentaries be free, and sort of the problems we had with people that weren't the creators of something dictating how their art should be available to the public. Like, mm-hmm. I do believe that should be in the hands of the creator.
Yeah.
So it's like, I would hate to say like the Impossible Burger has to do this strategy, but it's almost like just knowing how good it is and how much I think it will change people's minds about vegan meats. It's like, it seems like a shame to me that it's not accessible to more people.
I think that the Beyond Burger can do the same thing. I said this in the last episode. I said, if you gave this to someone without context, they would think that it was meat, 100%.
Well, so the difference with the Impossible Burger is I think if you gave that to someone with context, they wouldn't
really
be able to tell that it wasn't meat.
That's a strong claim, Andy.
Bold claim. Yeah. So, and I guess just with the image of veganism as being a very elitist and rich upper class, like white person thing to do, the fact that like the best possible version of a burger is not accessible to so many people, even people with money. It's like you have to be, you also have money and be in the location and be available to spend an hour at lunch.
Yeah.
It's so many barriers to entry.
That's true.
And like the Beyond Burger did when it started do a little publicity stunt. Like they sold out at the Whole Foods in Colorado where they first were, you know, and I'm guessing they probably had like 30 packages, you know, but to me that was like their way of trying to get the buzz going around it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, again, it's like, I can't get mad at them. I understand it. The article kind of says we have to market it the way millennials want it, which is like, it's like a broad generalization, I think, that like, oh, millennials need this super exclusive thing that's hard to get. And like, I get that. And it like, it felt cool when I got to try it. Yeah. Just like, it's like, it feels cool when I'm at Expo West and I get to try vegan products before other people. Like, you know, there's like that exclusivity.
Just had to rub it in, Andy.
But at the same time, it's like, I would much rather just have those things available to people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Side note, when the Beyond Burger finally comes to my Whole Foods, if it's in the frozen, like, meatless section, do you think I should take a bunch and just throw them in the meat section?
You could.
Do you think that'd be effective?
Sure. Why not?
Okay. Settled. No, I get what you're saying. I totally get what you're saying. I think looking at it as, like, oh, it's a shame that more people can't have this because it would change people's mind. If you truly think that the Impossible Burger is that much better than the Beyond Burger, then I would have to agree with you.
Yeah. So, you know, again, these people spent a long time developing this. They made a great product. Of course, they should get, I think they should, you know, profit off of this because it's not sustainable to expect things like this to just be given away for free. But there's like a balance to be had, I think.
And I mean, you would think that they are going to get it more profitable when they do release it to a wider market.
And that's something the article talked about was like, you're not going to convince people until they can actually try your thing.
Yeah.
So like the Beyond Burger, the article kind of was like, well, this thing's good for both and they could both learn from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, it was kind of, I guess, like us, like not really taking a stance on it. But it's like, yeah, you're not going to, you know, the buzz is only going to get you so far. I've had friends, non-vegan friends, message me and be like, where can I find that burger that you posted about? And, you know, I'm sad that I can't say, yeah, just go to your Whole Foods and get it. Go to your Stop and Shop and get it. Go to Walmart and get it. Like, you know, like Target, whatever it is, the thing that everybody has in their town.
Yeah.
It bums me out that I can't do that yet.
Definitely.
Like at that point, it's no longer like, you can't get it. I'm so cool. It's just like, oh, this is a bummer. Because you would try this and you would love it.
Yeah. And you would go vegan.
Yep. All for one burger.
No, that stinks. You're right. That does stink.
Yeah. Well, and also not that the Beyond Burger is currently super accessible because it's like $6 for two burgers, something like that. $6 or $7.
Yeah.
So hopefully those prices go down. I'm sure that it was expensive to develop, but it's at least available to people, you know, to physically purchase.
Yeah. Two at a time.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the Impossible Burger gets some more widespread release.
Yeah, they've been doing this strategy of like the exclusive thing. You know, now they're in LA, San Francisco, and New York City, maybe more, but those are the three I know. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, how long will they keep this up? Like, they can't keep getting more buzz after this has been, they've been doing it for years.
Yeah, yeah.
So at what point are they going to start to really roll it out to other locations?
Yeah. Hopefully soon.
Yeah.
Hopefully to my Whole Foods.
Hopefully right into your mouth, Paul.
Hopefully right. They just deliver it right to my door.
You can switch out your raw block of tofu for a pound of impossible meat.
Yeah, just uncooked.
All right. Let's get back on track. Okay. So I came across this article a while ago and I shared it with Paul and we discussed it. And it seems like there's a lot of really cool stuff in this article that would make a good full length discussion, but also kind of felt like so much of it is things we've just talked about at length, like a lot of welfare abolition kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I did want to bring it up to you, Paul, because we, in our like kind of how should vegans vote election episode, we were talking about, it was Prop 3, right? In Massachusetts.
I believe so.
And it was talking about the cage-free ballot and something that I actually really liked about it that I thought was kind of devious and very smart and strategic was how the law, which would require, you know, cage-free eggs and ban gestation crates and whatnot, wasn't really affecting Massachusetts because there's like three farms in Massachusetts that make those things. But it would require anything imported into that state to have those measures or not get it, not get imported in. And I was like, that's really smart because that's going to force someone in Iowa that's producing pork to adopt these things to sell it to someone in Massachusetts, whereas that vote would never pass in Iowa, you know? And I was wondering if that's going to kind of be the strategy moving forward, that they're going to keep kind of targeting like liberal towns. Mm-hmm. And this article, which is titled "How the Vegan Movement Broke Out of Its Echo Chamber and Finally Started Disrupting Things," can't necessarily say that I agree with all or most of the article. it's like incredibly heavy-handedly pro welfare reforms.
Yeah, and
we've talked about our opinions on that stuff before. But there was a quote in the article that kind of confirmed that suspicion that this is going to be a strategy moving forward. And so just reading from that, the Humane Society's success in Massachusetts suggests the same strategy can be replicated in other population-dense states with liberal majorities. In the next few months, Shapiro says, the organization intends to hire an outside polling firm to survey cities across the U.S. in order to pinpoint where a similar measure might find success in the next election cycle. So Paul, forgetting about all the other stuff the article says, like, what do you think about that kind of strategy?
I think that it seems very effective for what they are trying to do.
And how do you feel about what they're trying to do?
I still feel the same as I felt about it before. I'm not exactly sure how it's ultimately going to help the cause, because,
the cause being defined as creating a vegan world.
Yeah, creating a vegan world, because, you know, each of these times this happens, they get like, you know, 5-10 years to implement these changes. It's like, so we're talking, if you're going to all these different states and doing it, it's going to be decades before these changes right here would even be fully implemented. So it's like, I think it could possibly create a vegan world in like, but I think that would be a very, very long way away. In kind of what we've talked about before, where it's like, if you think about the amount of suffering caused to animals as like from 0 to 100, it's like each time you're cutting it in half, it's like, yeah, you're never technically going to reach zero. If you just keep cutting it in half, you'll probably get to a point where it would just be like the tipping point of that. And then people would go vegan. But I think that would be a very long way away.
Yeah. And
it's like, 'cause it's like, if you get someone to go vegan, obviously you need them to stay vegan as well. But if you get someone to go vegan, it's like, yeah, they've made that change now. They're stopping, like, monetarily, they're going to stop supporting that stuff immediately.
Yeah.
Versus, and not to, actually, I should preface that by saying, not to say that like, all this legal stuff doesn't have a very important place in vegan advocacy. And I think that all of these kind of, whenever a law or something gets changed like this, it does take a long time to implement. I think that's going to be true for causes that I would support as well. But if this is the thing that we're relying on, I think if this is the only thing we're relying on, it's going to take a very, very long time, or it would take a very long time.
Yeah.
But that being said, it's a good, it's what they're doing is going to be effective for what they are trying to do.
It's diabolical. Even though I'm not necessarily sure about the ends, I do love their means.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it is very diabolical.
like even though it's not the thing that I love, but it, knowing how much it irritates the animal agriculture industry and how upset they are and how it's this kind of like backdoor measure that they found, I'm sure it's only a matter of time before they start lobbying to close whatever loophole that is going to be or something.
Yeah.
But I do think it is quite devious. I think it's kind of great.
Yeah. So,
but you know, again, that is something that isn't, I guess it's like a measure for people that are never going to do anything ever. And I hate thinking in those terms because it seems defeatist. It's basically like, listen, the whole world's never going to be vegan, so we have to do what we can for the animals, even if that just means welfare reforms.
Yeah.
But where was I going with that? So yeah, it's but it's not doing anything really to change the hearts and minds of people and like how they fundamentally view animals within our society as being these autonomous sentient beings that are deserving of their freedom to be free from pain within reason, et cetera. Which, you know, leads into our main discussion.
Oh, that's what I was going to say.
However, we got one more news thing, which also leads into our main discussion. This is a quick one that I came across. You know, we're always talking about the effectiveness, the efficacy of various forms of activism. And within those conversations, you always see like, well, you have to, if you're not someone who gets out in the street and protests or does direct action, whatever, however you're going to define that, or this or that, that you're not engaging in quote unquote real activism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, one that always strikes me as very ableist because, you know, these in the physical world activism things are one, not always accessible. That's kind of ableist. Yep. It's not accessible to people who are poor with money. They're not accessible to people that are poor with time either. And so often a lot of people are left with, and maybe even just not accessible to people that aren't super motivated to go do those things, or people that are very shy or have social anxiety, like whatever it might be. And so a lot of those people fall back on like social media activism, armchair activism, some might call it. And people are like, that's not real activism. You're just sharing an article. Well, I came across this other article also at theqz.com.
Also shared by someone at some point.
It said social media has become an unwieldy nightmare for the meat industry.
Ooh.
I just found this super interesting. I'm just going to read a quote from the article. Social media is seen as the industry's worst nightmare, said Ted Bilyat.
I love
that name. an agribusiness consultant. So this is not like a vegan person saying it. This is a guy that works with the industries. Bilyat. Said Ted, according to the Global Meat News. This is like on a meat website. The concern is straightforward. Information travels across social media faster than the industry can react, making it difficult to assuage consumers' fears about their meat products.
Hell yeah. Bill yeah.
Bill yeah. So.
Bill yeah, brother.
I just think this is awesome. I think it's cool to see someone from that industry kind of acknowledging the role that social media plays. Mm-hmm. And this leads so perfectly into our discussion, Paul, but it kind of just shows that, you know, no action is too small, even if it's something like posting an article, maybe posting a petition, perhaps, potentially, and that people should keep sharing those things and don't let anyone, my takeaway is don't let anyone say you're not doing real activism if all you're doing is sharing. And they even, the article even talks about the value of these things being shared within echo chambers. You know, I think just off the top of my head, when I think about, you mentioned people need to stay vegan, we have a horrible rate of recidivism in veganism. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that is a place where there's value in that echo chamber of sort of these feelings and views on animals kind of being reaffirmed for those that are kind of maybe on the outer edges of it and kind of just looking in on most of their friends who are vegan and they, you know, things like that can perhaps help keep people vegan or keep people motivated.
Yeah, no, I agree. Definitely. I don't think I have anything to add.
All right. Well, so as we were searching and thinking about social media, Paul, you came across this article, which has spawned our topic of the week, our question of the week.
Are online petitions bad for animals?
So, Paul.
Yes, Andy.
I mean, I see people that are like, petitions are useless. They don't do anything. I kind of share that sentiment. Like it always seems like it's like the most bare possible minimum someone could do to support a cause. Mm-hmm. Well, at the same time, it's like, well, you know, why not? What's the harm in signing this petition? So this article came out and it was saying that not only petitions not effective, they're actually negative for animals. Mm-hmm. They're harmful for animals. They're harmful to vegan activism. So tell us more.
This comes from an article on Ecorazzi entitled Signing Petitions Promotes Animal Exploitations, a Deer Case Study, written by Ben Frost. Love that name.
Is that a supervillain in the Marvel comic universe?
So the article kind of starts by talking about one specific petition, online petition, and then generalizes it. So I'm just going to generalize it to the effect of all online petitions related to like animal advocacy. So I'll just quickly summarize what the specific petition was. It was basically there was a petition about it concerning a like the deer population in Colorado. So essentially the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, CPW, noticed that the deer population was about 100,000 short than being optimal. So to remedy this, they proposed to kill more mountain lions and black bears in order to protect those animals from, in order to prevent those animals from killing the deers, and in an attempt to raise back the deer population. So basically the online petition was saying how the killing of the bears and the mountain lions, or the culling bears and mountain lions, isn't actually focusing on the real reason for the deer population decline, and that the real reason was like habitat loss, development, oil and gas drilling, hunting, road construction, etc. So they were trying to say like, hey, don't kill these other animals to get the population back. Instead, do something to remedy like kind of the man-made problem of why there's a poor deer population. So that's what the online petition was. And you know, from the sound of it, you're like, okay, this sounds okay. Like,
don't kill animals.
Cool. Don't kill animals.
Sign me up. I'm a vegan. I don't want people killing animals.
Yeah. So, Mr. Frost goes into how the petition is actually, this specific petition is actually harmful to animals. It points out that, that the hunters in Colorado already kill about 1,300 bears and almost 500 mountain lions every year, and that the proposal from the CPW is actually to only increase 15 additional lions being killed and 25 more bears being killed. So the petition says nothing about preventing hunting of the bears and mountain lions to begin with. And it's really only like, you know, a handful more of bears and lions that would be killed. Obviously, any additional kills or any kills at all are bad. But the kind of percentage that they're increasing, the author argues, is minimal. And that the petition doesn't acknowledge at all that, like, hey, there's already this hunting going on that's really bad. And the author also says that some of the phrasing of the petition kind of, it's phrased in such a way that it's saying like, yeah, we need to get the deer population back so that we can kind of continue hunting them. And it might not say that explicitly, but the author's kind of saying that it does imply that the reasoning behind why someone might want to sign this is so that they can continue to hunt as many deer as they were before. Cause it was kind of, some of the wording of the petition was saying like, put like, you know, a temporary restriction on the hunting until populations get back to what they should be.
So it seems like this is, I agree with this, that it is kind of a flawed petition.
Mm-hmm.
But the title of the article says signing petitions promotes animal exploitation. So how is that possibly expanded into like every, how can this author possibly say every single petition ever is bad for animals and it like expands the exploitation of animals, Paul?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Andy. So from there, the author kind of then general, like Andy was just saying, then generalizes that kind of these petitions and single issue campaigns in general, how they mostly just, what they're doing is they're targeting obscure forms of animal exploitation in order to appeal to non-vegans, kind of simply to gain numbers. So it's like, things like hunting, or things like, oh, we want to prevent this needless killing of these bears and mountain lions, and we want to increase the population of deer. These are all things that don't affect non-vegans for most part, unless you are a hunter or something like that. But even some hunters might say like, oh, I want to do this so that I can keep hunting deer. But for most people that aren't even hunters, most non-vegans that aren't hunters, they can say like, oh yeah, that is a terrible thing. I don't want these animals to be killed. And this doesn't impact how I live my life at all. So it's going to have absolutely no impact if this passes on me, if I sign this petition. And I just pulled one quote from the article that I think kind of summarizes what the author's feeling about this. And just to give a forewarning to those weak of heart, the author, I read this article in such a way that I was like, oh, I can't believe the author is saying these things. And then I realized it's just that they're being so aggressive in their tone that it almost comes off as something that I should be disagreeing with. But then upon reflecting, I'm like, okay, I think I actually do agree with this. So I'm going to read this quote.
It's a punch in the face of knowledge, Paul. Yeah,
that's what I said. I was like, I feel like the author's saying things that I agree with, but I'm also being punched in the face. So this is a quote. More crucially, however, the coalition of vegans and non-vegans supporting the petition tells all non-vegans that while there is something morally problematic with the targeted exploitation, the exploitation that they themselves engage in, which is not the target of the petition, is perfectly acceptable. It feeds the false perception that veganism is nothing but a personal choice for those who are dedicated enough, and that to help animals, you simply need to oppose niche forms of exploitation that have no effect and require no change in behavior from the non-vegans who oppose them. Like all single-issue campaigns, petitions are comprised of thousands upon thousands of non-vegans who believe that in signing the petition, they are fulfilling their moral obligation to animals.
Damn. You feel beat up, Paul.
But I mean, I think so. Now we can start talking about it.
Okay.
I think.
Thanks for that permission.
You are welcome. I think that while I agree with most of this article, I think it doesn't leave the room that there can ever be something that, like an online petition or something, that is beneficial for animals. Like, I think a lot of it does matter in how these things are phrased and how these things are worded. But I do agree that it is easy for someone to say, like, oh yeah, I care about animals, let me sign this thing. And that really has no impact in their life. Like, if they were signing something, if there was a petition, like, for instance, if I was a meat eater and I shopped at Whole Foods and I was signing a petition that said, get rid of meat at Whole Foods, like, that would have an impact on my life, most likely. If I wanted to keep shopping at Whole Foods, that would have an effect on my behaviors and my actions, versus something like this, where if I'm not a hunter, if I don't even live in Colorado, I can just sign this petition and go and eat a hamburger 2 hours later.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely parallels to things we've talked about before, like petitions to end like the Yulin dog meat festival.
Yeah.
It's just, or even things like freeing the orcas at SeaWorld. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, I live in Connecticut. I'm never going to go to SeaWorld. But yeah, sure, whatever. Let me sign this thing and be done with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what this article is saying that we haven't maybe said is that it's not only saying oh yeah, if I'm a non-vegan, like, oh yeah, I'm going to do this and feel good about myself for doing it. But what this article is proposing is that, hey, vegans, when you do this, when you create these petitions and when you share these petitions, it's explicitly telling people that it is okay the other types of exploitation that they're doing. I think that's what this article is trying to propose.
Do you agree that that is actually the case? I'm thinking specifically, we had a single issue campaign episode and we both came to the conclusion that just because you're working on one issue doesn't mean that you're giving the okay for another issue. And so the article is making the assessment that any petition is part of a single issue campaign. I guess that the author would make that assumption because there's no petition that's like everyone to go vegan. You know, yeah. Like, that's not a realistic petition that anyone could make or enforce if it got the, you know, 100,000 signatures or anything.
Yeah.
So therefore, anything short of that is going to be addressing a small piece of this animal exploitation picture that we're dealing with. So do you agree that every petition, no matter what, is a single issue campaign?
I don't. However, I think that the specific example that they gave in this is an example of something like that, because I think there is an underlying message when you sign this specific petition that is, even if it's not for you specifically, it is not only saying like, oh yeah, we don't want these 20, 30 animals to be killed, it's also saying like, but it's okay, but we're actually kind of almost encouraging like the hunting industry. And I think that this example, and I think because to me, if I had read that petition, I probably would have said, yeah, this is great. I think it definitely encourages me when I do see these sort of online petitions and stuff like that to think about it, to think about the impacts of what would happen on like a less superficial level, on like a deeper level, because what this author points out is not something that's on the superficial level, I don't think. And in that, I think it's very important that we do that as well. Because no, I don't think that every single petition that has to do with animals is necessarily going to promote some other form of animal exploitation. But I do think that there are probably ways, and he keeps on and talks about it. I do think that there are probably ways that I could analyze some other petitions that I would have supported otherwise and been like, oh, wait, maybe there is some kind of underlying, even subconscious thing that's being promoted that I would disagree with.
Paul.
Yes, Andy.
Can you give me an example of a petition that would not be a single issue campaign?
I mean, I don't know if these petitions exist, but something like...
What's your dream petition, Paul?
Something like...
Aside from like getting Slipknot to play your basement or something.
Which would not be vegan because they probably throw like pigs heads around everywhere. But something like ban meat from Whole Foods.
But then isn't that saying meat sold elsewhere is okay?
But I think that...
It would need to be ban all meat everywhere.
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 But I don't think that you're right. You good?
I'm okay.
Okay. I don't think that a petition that said ban meat from Whole Foods, which I would not be surprised if that has existed at some point.
It must have.
I think that would be a positive step because you can also make the argument like, well, then people are just going to get meat elsewhere and that's going to increase the meat production for like Stop and Shop or something like that. I guess you could argue that. But I think that there are enough people that would shop solely at Whole Foods for like other reasons that would just then decrease their meat consumption.
And if Whole Foods stopped selling meat and accompanied it with a statement that said, you know, we are no longer selling meat because we have realized that there is no ethical way to procure it. Even the meat that we sell does not reach the standards that we have set forth for our store. You know, that would be a thing that their consumers would potentially pay attention to, mm-hmm. because people put a lot of trust in Whole Foods. Like they just, a lot of, you know, people who eat animal products walk through the doors and go, anything I get here, I can feel ethically okay with.
Yeah.
So if all of a sudden Whole Foods was like, yeah, we're just not doing that anymore, I think it might potentially lead some people to go vegetarian or vegan. Yeah. I think there would also just be a lot of angry, pissed off people, but that would still go buy meat somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's just a total tangent of what the effect of them stop selling meat is.
But that's still a single issue campaign.
Yeah, because it's not saying end all exploitation of animal everywhere.
Yeah.
So I guess that kind of, and again, this goes back to our single issue conversation, but is this just a case of you can't do everything, so nothing will be good enough? Like, obviously, vegan education, et cetera, but it's like, if you have the opportunity to help some animals, with the example of this petition, you could save, and I don't know if you, did you give the actual numbers? You said it was minuscule, but it was like 25 bears and 15 lions.
Yeah,
that's what you know, which again, obviously, the death of one animal is tragic, but it's like, okay, you could save those animals, potentially, with this petition. Isn't it better to save those animals than to not? Or are we looking at it and saying, it's kind of like, I had a roommate once who adopted a rat, or not adopted, bought a rat from a pet store, mm-hmm. and was like, well, this rat would be used for snake food, so I saved this rat's life. And I was kind of thinking, well, you've just condemned another rat to die, and you've shown them that this is a profitable business model, so it's just enabling more rats to die, rather than if none of these rats got sold, and they're like, okay, I guess we'll stop purchasing rats to sell to people. So is that kind of like the same thing? Like, it's like you're giving that go ahead.
Well, I do think that in this case, with this specific one, I think that there is like this underlying piece where it's enabling more deers, a greater deer population.
Deers?
Deer. It's enabling a greater deer population, which would then enable more deer to be hunted. So in the end, it might actually be more deaths because of it. And I think, yeah. I think overall, even if you don't 100% agree with this what this article is saying, I do think they put forth this idea that we should be looking deeper into petitions and the possible effects. And even like, that's not even a hypothetical effect. I don't think like the thing we were just talking about with Whole Foods, saying like, oh, if Whole Foods stops selling meat, people are going to go start, buy meat from Stop and Shop. I feel like that's more hypothetical than what the author is saying that this petition is going to do, which is just kind of like allow more people to hunt.
Yeah.
In which like would be a bad thing. So like I said, I think at the very least we should analyze these things more before just saying like, oh, save animals. Okay. Sign my name, click the petition, go for it.
Yeah.
That's my thoughts on this. I think the article is worth a good read. I think it's worth a good read, and it's worth, reserving your bias at first, because when I read it, I was like, disagree with everything this article is saying. And then I was like, oh wait, I do agree. This person is just slapping me in the face while I'm reading it.
Yes. Something to be said for the value of appropriate delivery methods, I guess.
But I guess it still got to me. So do you think that you disagree with it more than agree with it, or?
I mean, I guess I just see the value in certain petitions that don't address every problem in the world.
Yeah.
Again, this petition is a great example of one that's like kind of explicitly giving the go ahead to continue to hunt and kill more animals. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are ways that we can do it. And actually, like, I'm sure most people would read that and be like, okay, well, as long as a vegan, I sign it. And as a vegan, I share it and say, hey, this is I feel like if someone asked us for our advice, Paul, and like, what's the happy medium here? And we would say, well, when you share it, make sure you also include a message that's like, hey, just so you know, like, this is a thing. This isn't the only thing that you can do to help animals. You should also go vegan. But the article is also against that as well. The article is against, no matter how kind of beautifully you wrap it up and tie a nice little bow, it's still bad.
I was just about to read that quote from the article where the author says, this is not something that can be fixed by sharing a petition alongside a vegan message. The petition itself, as a systematic matter, necessarily promotes speciesism and continued exploitation regardless of any superficial packaging in which one may attempt to present it. So F you, Andy.
There just seems to be this kind of absolute way of thinking within that statement that rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, where it's like, the fact that is my one big problem with this article is the fact that they kind of make this statement where it's like 100% of these things are always going to be wrong. I'm not willing to like even consider the fact that any of these things are possibly good for animals. It's like online petitions, wrong, wrong, wrong.
Hashtag not all petitions.
So I do disagree with that. I think that you can't just make a broad statement like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that if I had a takeaway from this discussion and kind of examining my thoughts on this article, it was your point, which is we need to look a lot more carefully at the petitions that we sign.
Yeah.
But I'm not willing to totally throw petitions out, you know, as being necessarily inherently speciesist and, you know, bad for animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think in some ways it's good because public support for an issue is a really crucial key for social change. And seeing a petition going around that has 200 signatures that are against, you know, a certain practice or something, like, it kind of shows other people it's okay to feel like that's, you know, an abhorrent practice, mm-hmm. and that there are other people out there that are willing to fight against animal abuse.
Yeah.
I guess, again, it's just how you implement that and make sure that it's not something where it's just like a loophole for other animal exploitation.
Yeah. I agree. I think that was very well put.
Cool.
I think that's all I got to say about that.
Gotta wrap it up. Of course. We always want to hear what all you beers out there think about this. This is something I hadn't really thought about before, so this has kind of forced me to really knock some stuff around in the old noggin, and I'm still not entirely sure how I feel about it, but we want to hear what you have to say. Please send us an email. thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. Head over to the website, thebeardedvegans.com. We have a Facebook. We have an Instagram. You know how to find those things. You're an adult in the 21st century, right? That's where we are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, thanks to all those people who left us iTunes reviews. Keep leaving those iTunes reviews. Yeah.
Validate us.
And yeah, just, you know, tell us what you think. And you said that you hadn't really thought about this one, and that's how I kind of feel about the restaurant thing that we talked about way at the top of the episode.
Perhaps we will reconvene in a later episode with further thoughts.
That might be cool. Which I feel like would be an issue not necessarily just related to veganism, but just related to food in general.
Yeah.
Which just as important to talk about, though.
Absolutely.
All right. Do you have any events coming up, Andy?
I do, Paul.
All right.
I got a couple things.
Cool.
January 22nd, I will be at the Vegan Market, which is in New York, New York. It's actually in Brooklyn. It's a little pop-up market. I'll be there with all of my Compassion Company wares, all the vegan t-shirts, hoodies, etc.
When's that going to be?
January 22nd. Perhaps Paul will join me by the look on his face.
January 22nd.
This is not an event where I'll be selling things at, but February 4th, I am going to be one of the judges at Super Philly Chili Bowl, the best vegan chili in the city, and that's in Philadelphia, so it's going to be a bunch of people bringing their chili to a competition, and I get to do what I've always dreamed of, which is crushing people's hopes and dreams.
While eating delicious food.
Well, by telling them their food is horrible.
And Andy, of people that I know, I could not think of a better person that would be better at this. Because I've always told Andy, I feel like when I describe food, it just sounds so boring. I'm like, tempeh, bun, salad. And then when Andy describes it, he's like, the flavors.
Notes of tempeh.
Yeah.
A hint of bun.
So I will be there too, cheering Andy on the sideline.
Eat that chili. Eat that chili.
So yeah, I think I'll be there too.
Cool. And then February 25th, I'm going to be, after that the Philly Chili Bowl, I'm going to be trekking across the country. And so I'm going to be at the...
How am I going to be at? Where are you going to be at?
I'm going to be at the PHX Vegan Food Festival in Phoenix, Arizona.
Nice.
On February 25th. And then the farthest out we're going to look into March. March 26th, I'll be at the Vegan Street Fair in Los Angeles.
Ooh.
And all of those, you can find info at compassionco.com. I'll be peddling my wares. So come by, say hi, give me a high five.
I only have a couple more months with you, Andy.
That's why I came up today. I braved the rain, an hour of driving in the rain.
I appreciate
to see you,
that.
Paul.
I appreciate that greatly.
So that anyway, that wraps it up.
Yeah.
It's good to be back at the Commentist compound here.
Yeah.
Recording together again.
Yeah, I think that's it, Andy.
Paul, if I had to create a petition, it would be to get you to say these words right now.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.
It doesn't make any sense at all. Just sign it on that shining.
Hey Andy, did you see that movie The Witch with that great character Black Flamingo at the end of it?
Is he the one that turned into Captain Morgan at the end? Don't even get me started on that movie, Paul.
It's not good. It's not a good movie.
I didn't think it was great. Everyone loves it.
Yeah. All right. Let's go on that note. All right, let's get into the news. If you want to cut out that whole thing, go for it. Why were you smirking at me before, Andy?
Because you said looking deeper at like the deer situation, and all I could think of was looking deeper.
Nice.
So much so that I wrote it down, hoping that you would see it and laugh, but you did not.
Oh, rats. Oh, there it is.
And if Whole Foods stopped selling meat and accompanied it with a statement that said, we realize that we cannot ethically sell meat because it won't live up to the standards that even we have set for ourselves, people would potentially...
Yeah, because you farted over there.